today is, of course, a very interesting topic and very timely, hate speech and violence. Many of you know that I spent almost 10 years as district attorney in Boulder. We spent a lot of time sorting through those issues, hate crimes, when things could be prosecuted criminally, when they couldn't, and trying to strike the right balance between the constitutional protections that everybody in the United States is entitled to and the public's interest in public safety, appropriate public discourse, and making sure that we're not fomenting terrorism, et cetera, by our discussions. It's a very interesting and challenging issue. Let me introduce our four panelists. To my left is Andrea Gittleman. Andrea is with the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and she will be introducing herself a little bit more and some more comments here in a moment. Next to her is Jason Marsden, who's with the Matt Shepard Foundation, has been for, I believe, about 10 years. Jason and I interacted occasionally when I was district attorney as we were looking at issues to make sure that we had appropriate laws and policies to protect the LGBT community in Boulder County and also statewide. Next to Jason is Heather Hurlburt, who is a long time, was involved in the Clinton administration and other offices in Washington, D.C., and has been spending most of her career dealing with some of the issues that we're talking about today. And at the end is my old friend, Scott Levin. Scott and I were both employees in the Denver District Attorney's Office in 1981. We were both much younger and thinner in those days, or at least I was. I mean, Scott's in pretty good shape. He had a long career in private practice, a very distinguished, excellent lawyer, and now he's the executive director in Colorado for the Anti-Defamation League. So thanks to our panel. Let's give them a quick hand and then hear from them briefly.
Marsden.
Lynn, in the future, let's try to use, we're going to have two different ways. I'm supposed to read you this, so you know. There will be two ways to get us questions. One is the old-fashioned way, write them out on a card. And the other is, if you have the app, you can submit them by app, and I will get them here, supposedly, hopefully, on this laptop. And we hope together we can get the information and move along quickly. So let's start with Andrea. Andrea, can you spend a couple of minutes contextualizing your background, what you're doing currently, and some thoughts you have on these issues?
Sure. Well, thank you, Stan, and thank you all for being here. It's an honor for me to be at the conference. This is my first time here, and it's been an absolute joy. So I work with the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., and many of you might know that museum. Of course, tells the history of the Holocaust and serves as a memorial to the victims and survivors of the Holocaust. I work with a group within that museum called the Simon Scott Center for the Prevention of Genocide. So our goal is to use the lessons of the past, the lessons from the Holocaust, to prevent mass atrocities, including genocide today. So I'll speak about problems and concerns we have about hate speech, but within that framing. How do we understand hate speech in terms of connections or other ways it might relate to mass atrocities around the world today? So when I speak about mass atrocities, I'm talking about some of the most severe crimes that human beings can commit against each other. So crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocide, crimes where often there's an element of group-targeted violence, where victims are targeted on the basis of their identity. And this, I think there's often connections to hate speech. We know about, you know, hate speech during the Holocaust and how that fueled a lot of hatred and violence then. I think it's worth noting, however, that hate speech exists in, I would imagine, every country and probably every community. Every community is grappling with this in some way. Yet, thankfully, mass atrocities and genocide are quite rare. And so for us, what we try to do is understand how hate speech might relate to mass atrocities. How do we know, or how can we forecast if hate speech might be indicative of something? It could be violence on a grand scale, Maybe it might be indicative of violence on a smaller scale. And as concerned citizens of the world, we, of course, are concerned about hate speech and any negative effect it would have. But what if we're interested in that narrow spectrum of crimes where we're talking about mass atrocities? So I'll speak about that later during the questions and answers, but I think it's important to think about how hate speech can work in different places, who potential speakers might be. I think having a random person on the street spewing hatred has a very different effect than a politician, a religious leader, someone who has some kind of a following. So I think if we understand that hate speech is not this monolith, that actually if we dissect it a bit more, we might be able to understand what it does and then how it connects to mass atrocities. And I'd be happy to go into much more detail during the Q&A.
Thanks so much, Andrea. Jason?
Thank you. I'm very honored to be part of this venerable conference. And if you think this weather's crazy, y'all should come up to Casper, Wyoming sometime. They're going to get a foot of snow out of this one. So very excited to be in balmy Boulder today. I'm Jason Marsden. I'm the executive director of the Matthew Shepard Foundation. The foundation was created by the parents of Matthew Shepard in late 1998 after his murder in Laramie, Wyoming, in what became one of the country's more notorious anti-gay hate crimes in history. Their thought was that while they had the world's attention for a year or two, that they would use the funds generously donated by strangers to do some speaking, push for some legislation, and try to encourage parents to accept and nurture their LGBTQ kids. What instead happened is that two decades of advocacy work grew out of that initial effort, and an organization now headquartered in Denver works nationwide and in now 26 countries across the world trying to raise awareness around bias-motivated violence, and not just against LGBT people, but against people of any minority identity or, in many cases, several minority identities. We train police and prosecutors to better understand these cases, better identify them, get more just outcomes for survivors and the families of victims, and to raise the profile of this growing threat to public safety with decision makers. After two decades of decline, hate crimes have been on the rise for 3 years now, and against religious minorities and racial minorities especially. The number of hate crimes against Muslim persons has more than doubled since 2015. There are many factors in play. We all own shares in this great enterprise called America. We need to vote those shares, and we need to exercise our rights as shareholders in this country to set some social boundaries. So pleased to be a part of that work. We try to do it through the lens of individual stories because we find that's what motivates people to care and to act. And so I'd like to spotlight some of those stories today and find ways to help you take inspiration from those stories.
Thanks so much, Jason. Heather?
Thanks. It's really an honor to be on this panel with the four of you who have been on the front lines of this work for so many years when, frankly, it wouldn't have gotten the kind of attention that it got right now. So I really feel very honored to be included. My own background is that of having a career in American foreign policy and its politics and in watching what has come over our country in the last couple of years. I thought, well, there are a lot of lessons from the global experience with both spiraling downward from hate speech into violence and either stopping those spirals or reversing them. And frankly, we have a dismal record of failing to learn from them, failing to think they are relevant to us, and even most of the discourse that you read now about how to think about the threat of political violence in America is focused on political science models that act as if there's never been political violence anywhere else in the world, whereas, as Andrea and others can sadly tell us, of course, that isn't true. So I want to make two points as an introduction. One is that we, in retrospect, lived through the last 30 years as a really blissfully low political violence period, but our country has known lots of political violence over its history, the Civil War being the most obvious example, but centuries of both class-based political violence and race and gender-based political violence. And if you look back in history, I mean, it's very interesting that as the rates have risen in recent years, which we heard a little bit about and I'm sure we'll hear more about, they're getting back to the levels of the late 60s and early 70s. So this is something we know, which on the one hand should be positive because we've de-escalated in the past, but also the riverbeds are there for how this goes, and that's something that should concern all of us deeply. So if we're going to draw just a couple lessons from the global experience, what should we be most worried about? There are wonderful, enormous databases that have looked at 50 or 60 years of political violence within states and thought about what are the risk factors for that and how does hate speech play into it. The maybe single biggest risk threat is a democracy that is weakening and failing. And so that should concern everybody here pretty deeply. Mm-hmm. Second, elites. So there's often a misconception that hate speech and violence come from sort of ignorant masses of people. They don't. They're very much elite-driven phenomena, and they come from elites that are conducting no-holds-barred contests for power. You see how this is relevant to the previous panel in here, and become willing themselves to use extreme rhetoric and extreme speech. And that is where you start getting uncontrollable spirals again. We ought to be really worried about that. Perceptions of change in relative power in society through policy changes or elections, and perceptions of external threat or conflict, which normally we think, oh, we're so lucky here in America, we're a continental power, we don't have external threat, until you start to think of some of the rhetoric that we're hearing right now and how the otherization of foreigners, refugees, and immigrants really taps into this sense of external threat, which in turn amps your hate speech up to a new level. So that's my cheerful opening remark.
Thanks so much, Heather. Scott, is there any good news?
I'll give some real cheerful stuff, I'm sure. I'm Scott Levin. I'm the regional director for the Anti-Defamation League here in Colorado, New Mexico, and Wyoming. I don't have a nice name thing here, but just yell, hey, you, and Stan will know who that is. The Anti-Defamation League has been around since 1913, and it's always had the same mission, which has been to both stop the defamation of the Jewish people, which is to fight anti-Semitism. Those words didn't exist in 1913. But also to secure justice and fair treatment to all. And I think it's really the understanding that the world isn't going to be better for any one of us unless we can make it better for all of us. But because of the fact that Jewish people for a long time have been the focus of hateful rhetoric and violence that's been out there, it's also something that we study and we research. So I just want to give you a few figures, facts and figures to start this off. And you can use what the experience is for Jewish people as a bellwether, I think, for what's happening to the rest of the world. Because if this is happening to Jewish people who, quite frankly, have it fairly good in the country right now, we can only assume how bad it is then for people that are Muslim or Sikh or gay or women, as a matter of fact. All of these things have an effect. So one of the things that we track are anti-Semitic incidents. And these can be everything from an actual crime. Someone goes and vandalizes a place and puts a swastika on the side of a synagogue or assaults somebody. That would be a hate crime that you could prosecute. But what is it when somebody goes to the Costco that's out in Westminster on a snowy day and goes up to an 82-year-old Jewish woman's car and with their finger, in the snow, marks out a swastika? Probably not a crime, but certainly something that felt very, very horrible to that 82-year-old woman. Or when a middle school student on Valentine's Day takes pink slips of paper and slips them into everybody's locker with little love notes that say, "My heart burns for you like 6 million Jews." Not a crime, but certainly a hateful incident that's occurred, and an anti-Semitic one it could be. So just to give you a few figures in terms of the number of incidents that we've been tracking, in 2014, my office in just Colorado tracked 10 such incidents. 2015, it went to 18. That's a pretty big increase, but it's still not that many. In 2016, the election year, it went to 45. 2017, it went to 57. Last year, it'll be around 40. So this three-year period of time, we've seen some sort of an emboldenment. Something's been unleashed in the air in terms of hateful incidents that have taken place. Another couple really quick statistics. Colorado last year, in terms of gross actual numbers, had the third largest amount of white supremacist propaganda that was distributed of any state. Behind California and Texas, we had 73 incidents, including up here at the University of Colorado and in about 13 colleges around the state, as well as many neighborhoods, where white identity and white supremacist literature was put up. And then the final thing I want to tell you about is, where is the extreme violence coming from in America today? And this isn't a partisan statement. It's not political, even though some people will try to put it in those terms. But last year, there were 50 instances of murders and shootings that took place with extremists. In all 50, they came from right-wing supremacist type people who were expressing their violence. Over the past 10 years, that has come from that part of, or that ideology, about 75% of all extremist murders that are out there. I only point it out to you because the administration just announced last week it was doing away in the Department of Homeland Security with the people that investigate right-wing extremism. It didn't fit the ideology to say that all of this is coming from Islamic radicals. And that's just not what the figures bear out. So on that happy news, Stan.
Thank you so much, Scott. Well, what a great panel we have, and we're already getting really, really terrific questions. What I'm going to try to do with the questions, some will be for everybody, and some I will send to particular folks whose background would be appropriate. One of the reasons this issue is so interesting to me as a lawyer of 37 years is in the United States, under the United States Constitution and the Colorado Constitution, we all have many personal rights. And as I've watched our culture through the years, my impression is we've become almost obsessed with talking about everything through the lens of personal civil rights. We have a difficulty talking about anything with kind of a broader sense than that. A number of the first questions that we're getting go right to that issue, and I'd like to ask each one of you, this is going to be my edited version of about 8 questions. How do you define hate speech, and how do we ensure that we are protecting people's safety without censorship? Andrea, shall we start with you?
Sure. So when we think about hate speech in a global context, it's often hard to describe because it is so contextual. A lot of us know what hate speech might look like here. And how would we know what it would look like in Burundi or in Myanmar? There might be particular terms that, again, could be group targeted. They could be unfamiliar if you don't know the exact context. When we think about what we can do instead of censorship, I think people often say, well, we can't combat hate speech because we don't want to censor. We want to protect basic freedoms, of course. But there's a lot that you can do in order to counter hate speech. This has to be done strategically and very carefully because the stakes are so high, as we heard. As you can imagine, if someone is spewing, let's say, racial hatred, if you tell them you're being racist, chances are you will not change their actions and you will not change their mind about what they believe. So how do you actually confront hate speech when you see it? There are people who have worked with the Holocaust Museum and others who have described strategic counter speech initiatives. So not shutting down hateful speech, but rather combating hate speech with speech that is designed to counter that. For example, there's a woman named Rachel Brown who has started an organization called Over Zero. And she used to work in Kenya, which had violent post-electoral violence back in 2007. And at the next election, she wanted to make sure that people were confronting hate speech in order to mitigate the potential threat of group-targeted violence around that election. And the kinds of messages that were useful then were not, don't say racist things, don't categorize into us and them. Not those things that might come naturally to us, but rather things like, when you hear a rumor, how do you know if it's true? What will happen if you act upon that information? You might have heard something, but what is that person actually trying to get you to do? Think about what that person's motivations might be. And those kinds of messages might prompt more critical thinking that might actually make a potential audience member to hate speech think differently. So I think censorship is a fraught process. It might work in very, very limited cases. For example, in places like Sri Lanka or other places in South Asia where WhatsApp, the platform, is being used to actually orchestrate mass violence, where the platform is being used in a logistical fashion, not only spreading hate speech, but target this person at this place at this time. There are some people who are looking into actually shutting down platforms in order to stop that logistical function of violence. I would just put out there, because I think it's a complicated issue, that when you do that, you might also be eliminating important early warning systems for people. I mean, people might be using those same platforms to warn each other about potential acts of violence, to share information that could actually promote safety. So censorship really is not an easy solution, but I think by thinking through positive ways to counteract hate speech, you might actually reach a better place.
Thanks so much, Andrea. Jason?
Thank you. Hate speech is insidious, and in particular because it is often coded so that it is heard by those whom the speaker wishes to hear it and not heard by the rest of us. For a long time, this has been called the dog whistle in politics, coded messaging that is meant to activate prejudices that the speaker knows an audience has without alerting the rest of the world to the message of hatred and division that's being spread. The author Tegan Goddard is currently serializing a new political science work in which he describes the phenomenon of the last few years in which, as he puts it, the dog whistle has become a dog horn. These messages are put out plainly. They say exactly what the speaker is trying to communicate, and it is a provocation and a challenge, really, to the rest of us to try to muster enough speech to counterweight those messages. We know hate speech when we hear it because it generalizes. It plays to prejudices and stereotypes. It urges othering another person or another community. And it quite frequently suggests actions to deprive others of their liberty, of their dignity, of their property, and indeed, in some cases, their well-being or their lives. Our belief at the foundation is that it will take mass action by individuals of good conscience to counter this threat to our culture and our society. And I think in our culture, maybe we aren't quite as open with one another and affectionate with one another as we could be. We each are surrounded by a constellation of people who look to us as leaders, who look to us and say, I'd like to be more like her. I really wish I saw the world the way he does. I really admire how she's raising her kids, and I really respect how he's involved in public life. And we have social capital with one another and can use it strategically to counteract hatred, hate speech, or hate action when we see it in our individual lives. And maybe we're not going to see it from our close friends, relatives, or coworkers, but we might encounter it in the community, in the marketplace, or within social or civic institutions. And it doesn't have to be a confrontational action. In fact, it's our belief that gentle and inquisitive interaction is ultimately what will change the minds of people who gravitate toward hateful thought. I'm really surprised to hear you say that. You didn't strike me as the kind of person who believed that sort of thing. Tell me more about how did you come to think that? We can use thoughtful, affectionate inquiry to great social and political advantage in our daily lives every day, and it is in fact the only thing that will change this phenomenon is if we choose to do it by the millions. And so we try to put stories in front of people like Matt Shepard or like so many others who've gone unknown and unnamed to reach a deep emotional reserve of compassion and understanding and activate that in other people as they navigate their daily lives.
Thanks, Jason. Heather?
Wow, that's hard to follow. I want to really reinforce what you just said, and accept that I actually think that we all do encounter quite a bit of hate speech in our daily lives, and we're awfully used to it because when we encounter it, it's about categories of people that in our lives it's okay to other. And I think making the personal choice that it's not okay to other anybody is a really challenging one. For example, I was at an official luncheon here yesterday, and someone said something that would be experienced as fairly hateful by trans people. And I had this, ooh, am I going to say something? How can I say something? Is this person just going to turn on me if I'm like, could you maybe use sex instead of gender there? So I really, to support what you said, at the same time, and I'm going to leave the definition of hate speech for my colleague, the prosecutor here. We know that that hate speech doesn't travel equally through all users, as Andrea said at the beginning. And we, as citizens, really need to make demands that our elites not traffic in this kind of dog horn. We need to not reward elites who traffic in it, and that includes not just by not voting for them, but also by trying not to consume them as media products, which is an awfully, the dialogue of so-and-so says something scandalous and we all click on it, and so it makes money, and so the next time they say something more scandalous and it gets printed again, that's one of the ways that hate speech and dog horns are really insidious in our culture right now. The other comment I want to make from international experience is that it's not easy to change behavior or beliefs, but it turns out to be easier to change behavior. So sometimes maybe I can't get you to change what you secretly think in your inmost heart, and you probably can't get me to change mine either. But if I can dissuade you from publicizing your views, or if I can convince you that it's not socially acceptable to publicize your views, then at least the transmission and magnification of hate speech stops. And there's actually the really interesting experiment on this was used soap operas in Rwanda to try to change people's ideas about each other after the genocide. And, you know, if you feel hopeless about the U.S., as it's easy to do, imagine trying to do that work after the genocide in Rwanda. And people didn't tell researchers that their inner views had changed, but they did say, yeah, you know, it's not okay to do this. It's not okay to say that. And at some level, that's what we're shooting for. So sometimes it's more useful to think about behavior and how can we all sort of keep norms for civil discourse with each other, and that, you know, we all have some nasty thoughts in our hearts and they don't all need to be on our lips all the time.
Thanks, Heather. And I've been given a question reminding us all, including me, to speak right into the microphone.
Okay, good question. So from a legal perspective, in the United States of America, we don't have hate speech, right? Well, in some of the foreign experience, some speech is illegal. For instance, to have anti-Semitic speech in Germany would be violating their laws. In the United States of America, with our First Amendment, we do not prohibit hate speech. And we're a First Amendment organization. We think, as has been said by many a Supreme Court justice and others, that the best way to counter hate speech is with more good speech. Sometimes it's a little bit difficult to do that, though. When we're talking about hate speech, we're really talking about speech that is based on biases and bigotry. And usually it's over immutable, unchangeable circumstances that take place. Someone is a person of color. Someone is gay. Someone might be in a situation where they fall into a class, a woman, other things. You're not going to change those things. Those are immutable characteristics and ones that should have respect, not hate. At the Anti-Defamation League, we developed what's called the Pyramid of Hate, and it's really foundational to our educational programs, including in our No Place for Hate program, which I'm really proud to say we're in about 15 schools up here in the Boulder Valley area. But what it does is, in that Pyramid of Hate, it starts down at the bottom with the belittling slurs and comments and jokes and things people say to one another, and you work up into the more institutionalized kinds of hate speech, which results in people that will then not sell their house to you because of who you are, or not hire you because of who you are. And from there, based on those foundations, you get up to violence and essentially the worst of it, a genocide at the top of it. So we try to interrupt down at the base level of it. And even though hate speech isn't illegal, though, we know that a lot of it is taking place online. And our social media companies and other platforms that are available to you aren't the United States government. They can have terms of service. You know, that all those words that you click the box on and you don't read, that talk about the fact that you're in most of the basic ones, like a Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, are saying you're not going to make ad hominem attacks, personal attacks against people. You're not going to be using what I think we would generally understand to be hate speech. The question is getting those platforms to actually recognize it when it takes place and to actually enforce their own terms of service. So I think that when we talk about hate speech, it's something that we have to accept in the United States of America is going to be here, but it's certainly not something at all that we should accept as being acceptable. And as others have spoken, we need to speak out against it, we need to interrupt it, and we need to make sure that our leaders and role models do the same.
Great. Well, thanks for those comments, all four of you. And now the challenge in these things is to make sure we get through as many of the great questions as we can. So I'm going to pick individual questions, target a particular member of the panel, make sure everybody gets a chance. But after the person I ask answers, if anybody wants to add anything before we go to the next question, we will do that. Scott, since you're at the end, I want to start with you. We have a couple of different versions of the same question. Were Ilhan Omar's comments an example of anti-Semitic hate speech?
From my perspective, I can't tell you what was in Ilhan Omar's mind. I think there are classic anti-Semitic tropes that have existed for a long time. They've been around such things as dual loyalty, that someone that's Jewish might be loyal more to Israel than they are to this country. In the same way that President Kennedy faced it when he was running for office, that he would be more loyal to the Vatican than he would be to the United States. That's an insidious type of trope that's being made. When she made her comment also about it being all about the Benjamins, being a reference to being money, certainly as she explained, she was concerned about AIPAC, which is a very powerful lobbying organization where some might believe that there's a lot of money that flows through that organization to it. But it, to Jewish ears, not all, because we all hear things different ways, there's a sensitivity that there has been for a long time a trope that Jews are trying to influence the world by using money. The thing that makes these tropes so incredible is that they come from, it doesn't matter whether in a time like today where Jews might have some amount of affluence or influence in the world, but these all were developed earlier, during earlier times, over 1,000 years, if not more. A lot of them are put into print in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion that was done at the beginning of the 20th century by Tsarist police who made up these conspiracies that Jews were having to control the world. Those were at a time when Jews didn't have any influence at all that was going on. So did Ilhan Omar do that? I think she used impertinent, improper language at that time to convey whatever her message was. I certainly understand why people thought that that was anti-Semitic, but I can't judge in her mind where she was coming from.
Thanks so much, Scott. Anybody else want to add anything to that before we go to the next question? Heather, the next question is for you. What is appropriate and possible for the United States to do to respond to the creations of LGBTQ or any minority death penalties worldwide, most recently Brunei, as of this April?
Boy, thank you for asking that question. And I have to say I feel very paralyzed in responding to it because it's so hard to imagine very much that the current administration will do. So I'm going to try to get past that. And I think there's two There's two answers. One is there's actually a lot that the United States can do and has done or had been doing pretty steadily up to 2017 in international fora to establish that LGBTQ individuals have all the same rights as other individuals everywhere around the world, and that the rights established in the UN Charter apply fully to LGBTQ individuals. And actually, there had been some really interesting progress in the UN in the last 10 years in making prejudice and discrimination and violence against LGBTQ folks less sort of something that people just brushed off and didn't even notice. And we're now seeing the reverse of that. So that. There's a whole stream of things that the U.S. can do, did do, and was having some effect. It is also, I think, fair to say that there are contexts in which the way the U.S. acts can be experienced as and are very eagerly taken advantage of as, oh, this is neocolonial, you're imposing your values on us, et cetera, et cetera. So the way to get around that and never, ever give into it is to always lead in partnership with local activists. And in the Brunei case in particular, there are incredibly brave LGBTQ Brunei activists who have been speaking out, and anything that the U.S. ever does in Brunei or anywhere else should be clear that it's in support of those folks and their desire for freedom and equality and safety in their own societies. And it's them first, not us first.
Thanks so much, Heather. Jason, again, several different versions of this question. Some people seem to put forward hate speech as a pushback against what they see as an overly PC culture. How do we make anti-hate speech discussion seem reasonable as opposed to just being overly sensitive snowflakes?
Easy question.
Snowflakes. I hear that word snowflakes, and it sounds like a dog whistle to me 99.9 times out of 100. The idea that other people's sensitivity to historic and institutionalized discrimination and violence makes one such a wilting lily that one has violated our national standards for dignity or crudity, perhaps, it amuses me when I let it, and enrages me when I lose my concentration for a second. If our national ethos is that we should talk as crudely and imprecisely about others as we wish and call out the sensitivity of anyone who challenges it, then I want to look into Norwegian citizenship or something. I think in the moment is always the right time. I've encountered people who, when I've gently let them know that the proper way to refer to a person with transgender identity is blank, I have been told by other people that's the load of crap. And I try to always return to inquiry. I think the way that we set a standard for how we're going to talk about one another is to try to thoughtfully inquire why others don't want to do it. And I think there is a feeling of defensiveness. People feel threatened. People don't know, oh, there's new letters in the acronym, oh, I'll say the wrong thing. And it's easy for some people to say, I'm done with this. I'm not going to participate in the gradual making gentle of our life in this country. But we need to make gentle the life of this country, or we are not going to have this country for much longer. It feels to me like some people are looking to provoke us to react with anger and to shame them. And I think the way to avoid that trap is always to wonder, is always to ask why, and it is to listen and smile at cruelty from time to time and let cruelty know that we see the good in there and we would like it to come out as well.
Thanks so much, Jason.
Stan, could I just add one thing there? And that's just to say, this is not a zero-sum game. And I understand that people feel that they have a loss when they have to give something up. But I'm really sorry for your loss that you can no longer spout out whatever is on your mind about other people's sexual identity, their orientation, their color, their religion, or anything else. In America, we should be better.
Great. Heather, Andrea, that's a pretty broad question. Either of you want to weigh in at all? We got more good ones coming.
I can't imagine having anything better to say than that.
All right. All right, here's another question, and Andrea, this will be for you, and we've had several versions of it. I think it's really at the heart of what we're dealing with. It goes to the question of the Internet. The way this is phrased is, given the rise of the Internet as an anonymous platform, how should we go about regulating hate speech on that platform? If individual action is most effective, how do we portray that?
Great. Thank you for that question. So as was mentioned before, social media companies are not the government, and they have terms of service that the big companies, Twitter and Facebook, will use in order to decide whether a particular item needs to be taken down. The trouble with this is that it often relies on self-flagging. So when you're online, if you find something that you feel violates the terms of service, if it's racist, hateful, etc., you can flag it, and that goes through then a review system within the company. Things can be escalated. It often takes some time to make sure that what is being taken down is actually, it does violate those terms of service. It isn't just someone who doesn't like another person wants to take down their posts. This is really problematic. It's problematic in the United States, but when we think about other contexts, such as in Myanmar, which is a place where I've worked quite a bit, where Facebook in particular was used in order to rally anti-Muslim hatred and actually to provide some cover for perpetrators of mass atrocities, including genocide against that country's Rohingya Muslim population. What happens then? You know, Facebook said, well, you know, people within the country need to flag these hateful comments and we will review them. Well, these comments are written in different languages, often in Burmese, and Facebook at that time, years ago, did not have the staff to properly read and understand those messages and go through the required system. There were local researchers, and I think I'm so glad Heather mentioned these brave activists in Brunei. There are brave activists in so many places, members of vulnerable communities themselves, who are doing a lot of this work. Can you imagine being a member of a very targeted community within a country, speaking a language that is not spoken by a lot of these major social media companies, going through and flagging targeted attacks against you and your family and your community, knowing that you have to read that and that's your job, that's on you, to then let a social media company decide what to do with that information? We saw the disastrous results in Myanmar and elsewhere. There are still brave people doing that work, but can companies just rely on the terms of service? Something that we're trying to do as the Holocaust Museum is encourage companies to work more upstream. That when you have mass violence against a particular group that could be fueled by hate speech, you're already too late. So when you scramble to hire Burmese speakers to do more monitoring, or you try to find local networks within the country, that's a bit too late. So where should we be looking? Where should companies be monitoring a bit more closely, or building relationships with some of these brave activists so that they can respond proactively, they can understand the context, they'll know the kinds of tropes and terms that could be harmful, and are working with people who are understanding how people are changing those terms. You know, someone could spell something differently, and all of a sudden it's not getting picked up by people monitoring. So we are trying to encourage social media companies to be more proactive in terms of looking at early warning signs, looking at items beyond hate speech that could signal the potential for mass violence in the future. Heather mentioned before, you know, government change is often an indicator of potential political violence. For example, when a country is shifting from authoritarian rule to more democratic rule, that is an especially fragile time where vulnerable groups could face greater attacks. What if social media companies looked at places where their product was being used and that fits some of those characteristics? heuristics. Maybe those places they could do more of the reviewing and not rely so much on flags and user review. So it's a very complicated subject, but I think the onus could be put more on social media companies to do more to protect vulnerable communities around the world.
Thanks so much, Andrea. Anybody want to add to that?
I'll add.
Thanks, Heather.
Andrea gave a really great response, and I want to sort of go up one more level. You know, the social media company's job is to make money. And so how did we get here? And I've mentioned, and I want to keep mentioning, that the trouble with this stuff is that people click on it, first of all. And second, that, you know, many, many of us felt that so the coming of social media was an unalloyed good for the world. And certainly the visionaries who founded the companies felt that, and I think want to continue to feel it. And, you know, the question came up on the previous panel of how do we make space for members of different communities and of historically discriminated against communities in our lives. And I really think a huge part of this problem is that nobody in upper management at a social media company comes from groups that are strenuously historically discriminated against and subject to violence. That's a little bit of a more complex case for the Jewish community, but everybody else, it's very much the case. And so if the companies are not going to diversify and regulate and change their own perspective, which for all the reasons Andrea just laid out, that's happening awfully slowly, we do have this thing called the regulatory state. And certainly European governments are also thinking about this, and there's a real opportunity for global responses to thinking about how do we set manageable standards. And that's going to be very hard, among other things, because of differences. You know, we have the First Amendment and other countries don't. But because the social media companies are not limited by, you know, oh, everything that happens in the U.S. is controlled out of servers in the U.S. which fall under U.S. law, some of this is going to have to be an international conversation and a setting of international norms.
Thanks so much.
I just had one other really quick thing to think about is one of the things I'm very proud of, our organization was involved in the 1950s and 60s, were the unmasking laws. I don't know if you know about this, but the First Amendment allowed the Ku Klux Klan to go out and burn their crosses and say their awful things and do what they did. But the numbers of people in the KKK really dropped dramatically once laws were passed that required them to take their masks off. You know, how many of you saw To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, the movie, and Scout is when they come to the jail to try and get him out of to spirit him away in the jail, and she says, you know, well, hey, Mr. Smith, the pharmacist, and how's your son Joe, and all that stuff, and all of a sudden they sort of started feeling a sense of shame that people could recognize and identify them. The cat may be out of the bag in social media because, you know, it's a whack-a-mole process, but if there were a way to be able to keep some of that anonymity, I think, off of the social media platforms where people have to take responsibility for their own awful words they're saying, perhaps there will be a sense of shame that comes back to it.
Thanks so much, Scott. Jason, let me ask you this question with your experience at the Matthew Shepard Foundation. Do you think the pendulum will swing back to civility, or is this political climate the new normal?
I feel like there is a new normal, but nobody's quite sure what it is, and that we're competing with one another to establish what it will be. I'm pretty... You don't work in hate crimes for 10 years without being an optimist at heart. I'm optimistic that the moment we're living in is a moment in which we are actively establishing norms. I see the reception Judy and Dennis Shepard get in schools now. 10 years ago, we couldn't get them into a junior high because it's such a sensitive topic, you know. I've seen them get standing ovations from fourth graders in the last few years. I've seen the young people coming up who increasingly, if there are good anti-bullying programs in a school, there's an excellent chance it was dreamt up by 3 12-year-olds and that they have one or two teachers who are providing them resources and bandwidth and getting out of their way. I think we're all going to learn more about whether the rising generation has the power to reset some of the norms that have recently been broken in our socio-political sphere, but I'm endlessly confident that it will happen and that it's really just a question of timing. Will we allow tomorrow's leaders to take their place? Will we get out of their way? Will we inspire them that this is work they want to do? And will the public, in not just its ballot, but in its daily life, take up the cause? It's just, as Heather points out, politicians also thrive on clicks, sometimes literal and sometimes figurative. Certainly, when the marketplace starts to reject hateful messaging, be it through voting or be it through unfollowing people on social media, be it through news organizations choosing not to cover deliberately inflammatory actions or words, those political norms will change quickly because it will no longer be productive or profitable for people to spread those kinds of messages. We really just need to act in order to make it happen faster.
Thanks so much, Jason. Anybody else want to? I mean, that's very uplifting, and I think it's true, actually, about American history. It's often two steps forward, one step back. We've gotten several versions of this question. I think it is very timely and goes to the heart of a lot of things. Heather, let me start with you, and Andrea, I also want you to respond to this as well. Can you talk about the current administration's policies and rhetoric on immigration and any fears you may or may not have about the potential ramifications of that speech, i.e., do any of the panelists fear this will lead to violence/hate crimes? Heather, if you can start with that. And this may be one where everybody should weigh in. But we'll go to Andrea next.
It is already leading to violence and hate crimes. We are in the violence. It's not something that happens in the future. We are seeing both state-sponsored. What is happening to children at the border is state-sponsored violence. There's no other word for it. We are also seeing, and I believe you'll have better figures, but we are seeing upticks of violence against immigrants of all kinds. So this isn't something that's still out there. This is something that we're living in now. And one of the things that I worry about enormously as I think about various historical analogies is I think we tend to assume that political violence that spirals into mass violence is something that we see from day one. And we think about cases, whichever historical cases come to mind, and you think to yourself, oh, well, why didn't anyone do anything? And I think the answer is that elites who turn to violence start it in corners where it's not visible to those of us who are safe and comfortable and privileged in society. And I think that's what is happening to immigrants and people of color in this country right now. Andrea will have more sort of intelligent commentary on that. But the degree of, even if you remember the things that we found shocking in 2016, and they're now repeated routinely with no comment and no contextualization. And frankly, you know, I sat on a panel yesterday called America First. And I thought in 2016 that it was scandalous and horrifying that anybody would refer, that anyone would pick up that Nazi sympathizer slogan. And there I was on a panel where it was just normal. So I think on the immigrant issue, there's just so much prejudice and violence that's already normalized.
Thank you, Heather. Andrea?
Sure, thank you. And Heather, I think you laid out all the important issues. I would just add, in terms of the historical context, there's an exhibit now at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., if you're able to go there, about Americans and the Holocaust. And it looked at what Americans knew and how Americans were responding before there was even the capital H Holocaust, before people even were calling it that. So how were people responding to violence against Jews in Europe, and what kinds of policies were being pursued? And Heather, I think, hit it on the head. You kind of realize far down the road, well, why didn't we do something before? Some of the thing, I don't have the facts and figures in front of me, but there's polling at that time, in about the mid to late 30s, about the violence and persecution that Jews in Europe faced. And when ordinary Americans were asked,
they actually were concerned about this and saw it as a problem. And when asked, should we allow Jewish refugees to come to the United States, the answer is overwhelmingly no. And so people didn't categorize themselves as being hateful. Well, no, I hate Jewish people, so I wouldn't want them here. They were concerned about it, but then at the same time had this, as we would term today, anti-refugee sentiment. And so I think there could be questions today about how we not only are treating refugees and immigrants here, but how we're concerned about violence and mass atrocities in other countries. When we think about what's happening in Syria, we talk about the refugee crisis. But there have been, the catastrophic levels of violence in Syria could have been prevented by the U.S. and others years earlier. And so I think we need to be concerned about anti-immigrant and anti-refugee sentiment today, but also thinking about what we can do in order to make sure that we are preventing mass violence against people now. What lessons can we use from the Holocaust? And hate speech, I think, is one of those indicators that we often look to, but I think we can also look to various resiliencies. And it's hard, I think, to be hopeful about what's happening in the U.S. today, but as my colleague here mentioned earlier, there are some bright spots. When we think about some resiliencies, thinking about the creativity of young people in this country, thinking about all those people who are allies to vulnerable groups, there could be some bright spots, and if we focus on building those resiliencies, hopefully we can break away from these patterns of violence as well.
Thanks so much. Scott?
Let me just add one part to that. So the story that Andrea is talking about, among many others, some of you may have heard of the SS St. Louis, a ship that was laden full of Jews that was turned away and sent back, and many of the people died in the camps at the time. What's interesting to me is when you look at the exhibit, like at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, you read about it, is the rhetoric or the language of the American people about these people coming to steal jobs, these people having disease, these people being criminals, these people being subversives. And we hear a lot of that same language that's being used again today that marginalizes them and allows you to treat them as the other. Because that's the only, human nature is not to be mean and terrible, but if you can marginalize people and you can treat them differently, it's easy to do. The other thing that I just wanted to point out really quick in this immigration debate, one of the things that we're finding is so while this has entered the mainstream of politics, for those of us that have been around Colorado for more than 25 years, you'll remember when Congressman Tancredo led the fight, against immigration, and it was just poo-pooed. It was such a, they laughed it off. And now it's become really sort of an ideological or dogma of partisan politics. That's one thing. But the thing that I'm most concerned about is this is what's being picked up by these extremists that are out there, the white supremacists and the people that are not in the normal fold of either of the political parties that are out there. When they hear that language going on, it only validates what they're doing and empowers them, and itself feeds on itself. And so that's why I think what used to be something that was just discussed on the fringes just keeps working its way back into the closer and closer into the mainstream, to where now it is part of partisan politics. And unfortunately, if we can't interrupt that language, I think we're going to have a really hard time ahead on this issue of immigration.
Thank you. Jason?
Yeah, I'd just add specifically the dehumanization language is getting quite intense now, and it's just exactly as it was with the SS St. Louis. Steve King from Iowa, these guys have cantaloupe-sized calves because they're toting bales of marijuana across the desert. This accusation that the refugees who are fleeing unspeakable devastation in Central America, mostly engineered by governments that we have propped up for 30 years, are diseased or those guys are with MS-13, they're killers, they're rapists. It's gone well down the road. And I just want to add that we have a responsibility in the United States to actually understand Mexico and Central America. These people are our neighbors. They are vital to our hemisphere, and they play an important and good role in the world. They are an aspirational people. They are us. The State Department, before 2017, 2015 used to send me across Mexico to do programs for LGBT activists in cities all over the country. And what I found were well-educated, ambitious people who were fighting against a culture of corruption and violence and making real progress. But I also have farm folks in my family who have never probably been south of Arizona. And the attitudes that they've absorbed through this climate of dehumanization are really quite shocking. The Mexican people don't understand how we see them. They are European Americans. They are us. And increasingly, we will be harming our country by failing to understand them at the human level.
Okay, I think we'll have time for a couple more questions. This one I want to ask everybody to respond briefly to because we've gotten several different versions of it. So, Andrea, I'll start with you, and then after the next one or two questions, we'll have you each do a closing comment and we'll be done. This question is, how do you take into account your own privilege when talking about hate speech since everyone on the panel is white?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think this it probably is cast into stark relief when you think about how you're going to counter hate speech. I think Jason's advice is really important to have those kinds of loving, thoughtful, gentle conversations if you're able to do it. I might be able to do that. Some of the activists in Brunei maybe are not able to have those same conversations with their neighbors. Some of the people who I've worked with in Myanmar and South Sudan live in such intense fear that they might not be able to even bring that up, that even questioning someone's hateful rhetoric could have devastating consequences to them and their families. I think that's important to remember, and to remember that as a white American who's often working abroad, that there's so little we know, and often we don't know how much we don't know about particular context. Going back to Heather's comment about working with local groups, when they are doing a lot of the monitoring on hate speech and tracking some of these early warning signs of mass violence, I think it requires a heavy dose of humility and understanding, and letting a lot of those local groups really take the lead in telling us. We might have historical knowledge that could be useful. We might have tools and resources that could improve the situation, but we need to take the lead from people who actually are understanding the context, understand the risks, knowing that we might not face the same kinds of risks. We need to remember that when we're talking about hate speech and mass violence, the stakes are incredibly high, maybe not for us, but for a lot of the people with whom we work. And I think it's a perennial issue that always needs to be in the forefront of our minds.
Thanks, Andrea. Jason?
Yeah, well, I can't underscore that enough. There's room for almost nothing but humility in approaching this work. I grew up in a lily-white farm town in southern Minnesota, and I've been on a journey through my life to understand all the ways in which I am a legacy of and an exemplar of discrimination and hatred. I was born on Native American land. We're sitting here today on Native American land. Those of us who are of European American heritage have a deep historic responsibility for devastating and distorting the lives of Native populations. We all face a mountain of our own ignorance every day if we face up to it. We came out of, our organization came out of the murder of a privileged white male who, other than his identity as a gay person, would strike some as a symbol of oppression. And so we try to approach this work in a way that understands the vulnerabilities we all share in creating the society that perpetuates some of this institutional violence.
Thanks, Jason. Heather?
So rather than repeat what Jason and Andrea have said, which I agree with all of, I'll add two things. One is, as a white upper middle class person sitting in this situation. It's my responsibility to really center the voices and send you away knowing more and wanting to know more about the voices of groups and people who aren't represented here. So a couple of commercials. You should go see every panel that Nadia Ferozvi is on here. You should go check out every panel that the woman who runs the Ms. Foundation is on here. Those are just two people as a start. You should check out the work of Muslim Advocates, which is an association of American Muslim lawyers. You should check out the work of ISPU, which I think is Institute for Social Policy and Understanding. I apologize if I'm not getting quite right. American Muslims trying to use social policy and conversations like these to build tolerance and understanding. And then you go away and you make a note to yourself that every single person you recommend to the conference as a speaker for next year should be not a white person.
And a white male at that, right? You know, it's true. So I don't want to repeat things that are said either, but I think that I'm so glad that this question comes up because, for me, using the word that Jason did, I think I'm on a journey, as I hope many of you are, to understand what privilege is and what we can be doing about it. The only thing that I would add, and I'm really pleased that my friend Jason Marsden is here, is that we also need to be working in coalition with one another. Jason and I are both on an organization that we formed in January of 2017, Mountain States Against Hate, which has about 17 advocacy groups from communities of color, LGBTQ+, different religions, including Muslim, Jewish, and Sikh. And I think part of this is that we need to be able to work with one another, not so that we can lift each other up, because people can do that, but how we can figure out how the hell to get out of their way so that they can rise too. And that's part of what my journey is.
Great. Thank you, Scott. We've got exactly 4 minutes left, which means each of you have 30 seconds to say one final thought for this great, what a great panel you've been, and what a great discussion, great questions. Sorry we couldn't get to them all. Andrea, what would you say in 30 seconds?
Oh, my goodness. I think, to sum up, it's really important to understand hate speech as perhaps a canary in the coal mine when it comes to future mass violence, but not the only thing. I think if we consider hate speech as a spectrum of problems that can all lead to mass violence, I think we'll understand more what to do. If we think about what kind of resiliencies exist or do not exist, is hate speech coming from a particular group? Is it coming from police officers? Is it coming from people in government? I think if we understand what speech is doing and who it's coming from, we'll be better placed to combat it.
Great. Jason?
The situation is not hopeless, but it is urgent. There is time value to this work. The kids who are in schools today being bullied are going to get one childhood, and this is it. And it cannot wait until the next school board election or until the next presidential election to be resolved. It needs to be resolved now. Kids who are bullied show differential outcomes throughout their entire lives that are similar in lifespan and health to smoking a pack of cigarettes a day. Every one of us can change these norms in our community. Every one of us needs to be involved in it. Yesterday, go forth, use your voice, use your strength.
Thanks, Jason. Heather?
As this situation in our country gets more dire and hate speech gets more frequent and virulent as it's going to over the next 18 months, you all are our backstop. You all are where I am in Washington is not where the resiliency is. You all are where it is. So please, thank you for coming. Please don't get tired. Do what you need to do to keep yourself in shape, to keep doing this work. And if not you, who?
And Scott.
Thank you. Speech is something that each and every one of us can control. We can choose what comes out of our mouth, and we can certainly use those words that come out of our mouth to challenge those with whom we do not agree what's coming out of their mouths. So Martin Luther King said it best, the arc of the moral universe is long, and it bends towards justice. For many of us, we thought it was bending pretty good there for a while. Some of us might think it's not bending so much, but if you use your voice, your speech, lean into it, you will get us towards justice. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Let's end it there. Thank you very much.